Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have the annual faculty reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program. Our speakers are, in order of appearance, Dan Chasen, Leslie Epstein, Ha Jin, Sigrid Nunez, and Robert Pinsky. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Creative Writing Program Director, Leslie Epstein.
Welcome to the BU annual faculty reading, which is a great event for us, and I think for the city as well. We're going to read tonight in alphabetical order, and that means we're going to start with Dan Chasen, who is, I think, perhaps now the leading critic and certainly reviewer of poetry in America, a wonderful poet. And Dan has been with us the last 2 years, and we hope for many, many years in the future. So Dan Chasen.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie. I'm not sure this is a very good idea at all, actually. It's an existential play in one act. It's really a poem. I would never want it to be performed, and you really couldn't perform it, but I needed the advantages of drama. I needed conflict and character and the feeling of three dimensions of a stage and so on. So I wrote it as a play. It's called The Ferris Wheel in Paris. It has two characters, both played by me. Dramatis personae, a man, a fairy. The Ferris Wheel in Paris. An empty stage, man stands at the front of the stage. Man. There would have to have been first something, first darkness, then a stage, then an actor and an audience. There must have been a single play, and then the idea of theater, and the human drive to be entertained, or just to be happy. Curiosity about this category, human, must have been prior, must have been ancient. For a fairy to appear, there had to be fairies. For her to say my name, and I was there, standing at the stage's edge, saying my name. I had to exist already. My life had to be already making its way forward in the world. For me to have anything to say, to sketch my predicament, to introduce some key traits, for me to be granted a wish, for me to wish to return to my conception and turn on the lights, to explain to the disheveled lovers why making me was a mistake, I had to exist already. Fairy, slight and with incandescent wings, appears. She carries a child's guitar. Fairy, I can make it so you exist. I can grant that wish, but it comes with a condition. Man, to exist, I must exit the stage. Is that it? Is that the condition? Fairy, yes, if you exist, you must use your existence to erase every worldly trace of yourself, and you must start by exiting this stage. Man, but what will the audience do once I've exited? Fairy, singing and playing her guitar. At first, they will remember you vaguely, as though your voice were drowned out by gossipers at a cocktail party, and with it, the details of your plot. Then they will hear only rumors of you, which, since they seem so bizarre, they will ascribe to innuendo. Then only silence where you were. Man, and this process will take how long? Fairy, you will not know until you are finished it, and when you are finished it, you won't know. Man, why should I be created just to undo my creation? Fairy, this is a common question and unanswerable. Man, as a child, I had a stuffed dolphin. I carried it with me everywhere. I think what I would like now is a symbol to carry around with me in my mind. Can I choose a symbol just to make the process easier? I'm scared. I think if I had a symbol, I would not be so scared. Fairy, playing her guitar. Your symbol is the Ferris wheel that gobbles its own tail, the peaceful circle, the serene return to origin and out again, as though the return never happened, the journey undoing the return undoing the journey, the pattern made from the pattern it traces, a pattern that by tracing it, it erases. Man. My children loved the Ferris wheel in Paris. We shared a cramped car with a piano teacher from Lyon. You had a feeling that the world was wide, that people went to such beautiful lengths to abate each other's misery. On the Ferris wheel, I can remember thinking, how odd that I'm thinking not about the Paris skyline, which I had never seen, though I was 39, but about the Paris Ferris wheel, a principle of human self-obsession that has many hazards. But at that moment, riding the Ferris wheel, not at all interested in the Champs or Notre Dame, it felt like an affirmation of what is really human. I thought of community theater for some reason. I had a deep wish that someday my boys would play Clara in a drag version of the Nutcracker. The weird things people do to make each other happy. Not each other, no. To make the human race average out happy, so we break even in the long run with pain. And my children smiling beside me. And the piano teacher took our picture. We represented to her what she represented to us, some potential breadth in human empathy, a break from the loneliness mid-century plays describe, a way to think of children without sentimentality, and more importantly, of strangers just as they are in a shared Ferris wheel car and without metaphysical cliché. Fairy. Empathy is hard. It paralyzes people. You should indulge it only occasionally. The result is the same either way. Your work must be tireless, and even, I'm sorry, a little pitiless. Man. So now I must exit the stage. Fairy. Now you must exit the stage. Man hesitates a moment. Fairy starts weeping uncontrollably, her tiny body heaving in deep sobs, as she repeats, I'm sorry, oh God, I'm sorry, in a voice the audience suddenly realizes is intimately familiar to the man. The man comforts her awkwardly. It is as though they have known one another for many years, as though this were the culmination of many moments between them. The man is torn between his desire to comfort his dear friend and his wish not to appear to the audience to know her personally. As her sadness deepens, his self-consciousness grows. Now everyone surely can see that they are lovers. He wishes they could perform the entire play over from beginning to end. He can see that he broke character. He thinks that if he can stay in character himself, maybe this once he could keep her in character. He wishes to start the play over. Fairy grants man his wish. The stage goes dark. The lights come on. An empty stage. Man stands at the front of the stage. The end. Thank you.
Well, I'm next, and I thought I would risk the riots I'm told would break out in the streets if I don't read Leave Goldcorn for the first time in many years. This is a beginning of a new project, a novel about the making of a movie, and the making of a war. And interspersed throughout, there are short scenes with Jack Warner, Jack L. Warner, the head of Warner Brothers. This scene is narrated by Abdul Marjan. Abdul was perhaps the man that, maybe the only man that Jack really loved in his life. He was a Turkish boxer who became Jack's masseur, private masseur. You can look him up. He was in a couple of movies. He was called the Terrible Turk. That was his ring name when he boxed. And he was also very fond of Jack, and when he died, he left all his belongings to Jack. The only other thing you have to know, this is set in April 1942, immediately after Jack Warner has gotten his colonel's uniform in the U.S. Air Force, which is true. He did become one to join the effort in World War II. He's just put his uniform on. They've come out of the wardrobe department. One of the characters, whose name is Rido Loshak. Rido was a famous costume designer at Warner Brothers. Everything else is pretty self-explanatory. The things that the Epstein brothers say in the course of this, they actually said in life. So April 1942. This is Abdul speaking. We all followed the chief, or maybe now I should call him the colonel, from the wardrobe department and out of doors. It was a nice spring day in the valley, a blue sky with what in Anatolia we call horsetail clouds. The chief, as soon as he got outside, put his hand up to the visor of his cap and stared up at the sky. It was a habit he had developed, not to look at the clouds, but for the bombers and fighters of the Japs. We were right in line with the aircraft plants in Burbank, which is why he had the set painters splash a big sign and an arrow on top of one of the sound stages, Lockheed That-a-way. It was a gag, naturally, except it wasn't, not really. He actually did that. Anyhow, who should come past the guardhouse of the main gate but Julius J. Epstein and his brother Phil? This, for the chief, was worse than a flight of zeros. He stopped short. So did the twins. They looked at J. L. Warner. Then they looked at each other. The two of their bald heads turned pink, like eggs we color at Easter. You could see that they were about to double up in laughter. Instead, they did the opposite. I mean, they stood up so straight, they were bending backward, and as if they'd rehearsed it, saluted. Then they saluted again and were about to do it for the third time when the chief, his arms were already down at his side and twitching as if he were holding off an invisible whip, said, all right, knock it off. The boys, which is what everybody called them, simultaneously said, yes, sir, colonel, yes, sir. Lieutenant Colonel, damn it. Julie, scandalized. Didn't they tell him, Phil, that a colonel is higher? Just behind me, I could hear Miss Lancaster giggle. So did the two writers. One or the other of them, I could not tell which pea in the pod, said, hi there, Hadassah. What the hell is that supposed to mean? Well, just about everybody knew, even if the chief did not, that one of the boys had stolen a piece of stationery from his office. Last December, when Miss Lancaster arrived, she got a letter. Date, December 2nd, 1941. Subject, screen name. To Carolina Longa, from Jack L. Warner. Dear Miss Longa, this is just a brief note to welcome you into the Warner Brothers family. My brothers and I look forward to a long and fruitful association with you. We are certain that you will have a sparkling career under your new name, Hadassah Felberbaum. Regards to your mother in the old country, J.L. Warner, parentheses, please call me Jack. They copied his signature right down to the loop on the J and the swoop underneath. The two of them started in with the same kind of laughter, to my ear like the sound of crows. Haw, haw, haw. The chief all the time was frowning down at his watch. Do you two have any idea what time it is? Let me be the first to tell you. 2:02. Thank you, Jack. We had no idea. I'll give you an additional piece of information. Your contract says you have to be in your office and at work by 9 a.m. You aren't fooling anybody. I know damn well you stroll in after lunch every damn day. Don't you know we're trying to get out a picture? Right now, we're on our way to test Miss Lancaster, and we don't even have the lines for her to speak. But at least she's working. I'm working. Righto here is working, too. What makes you so special? I'm getting tired of it. What are you doing? Playing tennis at Roxbury? Don't lie to me. We got our spies. We weren't playing tennis, Jack. But we do need a fourth this Sunday, and... I'm getting worked up. A butcher shows up at a butcher shop at 9. A clerk sits down at his desk at 9 o'clock, too. Even bank presidents start work at 9. Fine, said Julie. Or maybe it was Phil. Then why don't you hire a bank president to finish the script? I'll tell the jokes around here. As of today, this stops. I'm going to tell the guardhouse to write down whenever you two come in and send me a report. After 2 o'clock, and with a war on. Well, we'd have been in sooner, except that Hal told us to go over to Culver City. What the hell for? They got better courts over there? Didn't he tell you? We're trying to talk Selznick into loaning us Bergman for the picture. Selznick, said the chief, looking up at the sky once more, but this time for inspiration. Bergman. Little Rido came forward and whispered something in the colonel's ear. Oh, yeah, Ingrid. Well, what happened? Make it snappy. The Epstein started in. Each one speaks a separate line here. He was eating lunch right at his desk. Soup. Tomato soup. With a spoon. For Christ's sakes, why don't you tell me what he had for breakfast while you're at it? What the hell happened? Well, we told him all about the picture, how there's this American saloon keeper in Morocco, and his old girlfriend shows up, and the letters of transit, and the Germans are putting pressure on the Vichy officials, and not once does he look up from his soup, but he just keeps spooning it in as if we weren't there at all. So finally, Phil said, it's just a lot of slick like Algiers. And he puts down his spoon and lifts up his head and says, okay, you can have her. I want de Havilland in return. Jack says, de Havilland? Once more, Rido went up on tiptoes and whispered in his ear, oh, yeah, right, okay, you can have her. Great, said Julius J. Now we know who to write Ilse's lines for. From the shadow that passed over the chief's face, you'd have thought that much bigger clouds had moved over the sun. And from the way he grabbed Miss Lancaster's arm and tried to pull her away, you'd have thought it was about to rain. But the Fraulein stood her ground. Ilse, she said, isn't that my part? Weren't we going to test for it now? Uh-oh, said Phil. You said it, said Julie. The chief turned on the two of them. Now look what you've done. Loose lips, said one of the twins. Sink ships, said the other. I might make it loose hips, sink ships. That might be better. Miss Lancaster yanked her arm from the chief's grips. Don't you touch me. The perfect face, you said, the perfect accent, is no different here than in the Third Reich, but at least Herr Goebbels keeps his word. I would have been Annelie if I'd stayed, the model for the German woman. Rido, the costume man, said, you don't mean that, darling. You're in a free country now. Suddenly the girl burst into tears. If it was an act, then in my opinion she deserved an Academy Award. They came spurting out of her. Rain after all. The chief put his arm with the oak leaf cluster on the sleeve around her. Stop it. I can't stand crying. If you don't stop, I'll start crying too. But that seemed to make it worse. Look, there was a misunderstanding. The left hand, you know, doesn't listen to the right. I'll give that Wallace a real dressing down, that son of a... whose name is on this water tower anyway? A W and an A and a... That's as far as this spelling is could get. You've got to stop crying. Didn't you hear there is a drought? Please, I'm on my knees, so to speak. Don't worry. Look how beautiful you are. And listen to you. What acting. You just passed your screen test. We've got another part for you, a great part. That seemed to grab her attention. The chief looked around desperately at the Epstein twins. Right, boys? Then, with what they call in the business sotto voce, right? Sure, there's this foreign refugee, a Bulgarian, a Romanian, from Croatia, maybe. What the hell does it matter where she's from as long as she's got an accent? This is perfect for Caroline. She's beautiful, okay? With a neck and a figure, a knockout, young, vivacious, lost in a foreign land. You hear that, sweetheart? It's practically written for you. Here's how I see it. How you have suffered, fleeing for your life from the Nazis. It's absolutely heartrending. Four handkerchiefs. Then thank God this happened. I see the hand of Providence. Fräulein Caroline Lange, she was going to be a model for all German women. But now Miss Caroline Lancaster, Miss Caroline Lancaster. He paused. It was like the imaginary clouds had parted. You could see the sunbeams on his face and the way they bounced off his teeth. She'll be the symbol of all German victims, the persecuted, the nameless, the hunted. All right, my sweet? Everything okay now? You are the hope. You are the dream for all the wretched of the earth. Behind his back, the two writers pantomimed, clapping their hands together. And to tell the truth, at this performance, I almost broke into applause myself. Thank you. I think one of the reasons we're so successfully an international program is that Hajin is part of it. Many students rightly want to study with him. His work has an international impact. All the books are translated into many languages, and in fact, I think his last book, Nanjing Requiem, is a bestseller in China. Is that right?
Money.
He doesn't get the money, that's right. But for me, and I think for the program, it's Hajin, the writer, Hajin, the teacher, and I think we're lucky enough to know Hajin, the man, that we so much appreciate. Hajin.
Thank you. I'm going to read from a novel I've been working on titled A Map of a Betrayal. This is about a Chinese spy who came to the United States and lived in the country for many years, eventually died here. And the narrator of this novel is his daughter, an American woman, who is a history professor in Maryland. But the novel has two lines, two stories. One is her own, told in the first person, the process of her rediscovering her father's first family back in China. And the other story is her father's story, told in the third person, but in the same voice, her voice. Because she's a history professor, now she's trying to reconstruct her father's story. And this is the moment her father had been now, by this point, he had been with the American intelligence unit agency in Okinawa for some years. This is the first time he returned to China. So I'm going to start at the lunch where he met his handler, who is also his friend. I'm going to read from the middle of the lunch. A ferryboat blew its horn like a mooing cow, chugging away from the waterside and dragging a frothy wake. Bing Wen said, "You are from Shandong, so we are having dumplings for this welcome home lunch." "Thanks. When can I go back? You know, I haven't seen my family for 5 years. Ah, that's another matter I'm supposed to discuss with you. Bing Wen smiled cunningly, his hawk eyes rolling, as if to check whether the other 7 or 8 diners were eavesdropping. They were all out of earshot, he said to Gary. Your family's fine. We've been taking good care of them. Can I go back to see my folks just for a short visit? No, you cannot, because the moment you cross the border, the Brits will inform the Yanks about you, and that will blow your cover. The party wants you to stay with the U.S. agency in Okinawa and to gather as much intelligence as you can. For this mission, your identity must be kept secret. Brother, I know this is hard on you. For you, you've been making great, tremendous sacrifice for our country. For that, you have our highest respect. Hearing that, Gary felt touched, but also disarmed, unable to push his request anymore. A dull pain seized his heart again, while a hot lump was swelling his throat. He lowered his eyes and asked, what if the agency moves back to the United States? There has been talk about that. Go with them. That's the instructions from above. Gary frowned, breathing hard as though something was stuck in his esophagus. Look, I'm going to be 30 in a month, and this celibate life isn't easy for me. His voice took on a grudging note. I won't say I miss my wife terribly like a newlywed. My parents picked her out for me, but I feel bad, guilty. I shouldn't have treated Yufeng this way. Besides, I miss home. We know Yufeng is a good woman. She understands you've been doing an indispensable job, service to our country. As for your personal life, Bing Wen blinked meaningfully and gave a tight smile. The higher-ups deliberated that too. If necessary, you should consider starting another family abroad. This also means you must prepare to live overseas for many years. So, mine is a protracted mission? That's right. Gary was stunned, then managed to say, okay, I understand. He came within a breath of protesting, but realized that would only make matters worse and might jeopardize his family. He heaved a sigh, unable to fathom the full implications of the directive. Much as he was happy to see his friend plus handler, the welcome home lunch felt like a letdown. In addition to the $500 in the envelope, Bing Wen notified Gary that he had been promoted to rank 18, the same as a first lieutenant in the army. From now on, he would earn 2 salaries a month, $230 from the American agency and 74 yuan, about $60 from the payroll of China's Ministry of National Security. He was sure that few of his comrades were paid so well. That lessened his despondency a little. If he lived frugally and saved some greenbacks, someday he'd be able to return home a wealthy man. Still, hard as he tried, he couldn't reason away his misery. Hong Kong was warm in February, and there was a scent of spring in the air. The streets were overflowing with pedestrians, and many of them in rags, apparently refugees from the inland. Oh, by the way, this was in 1954. Yet few wore country-padded clothes or heavy coats as people did in the north. Walking back to his hotel, Gary heard pigeons cooing and raised his head to look around, but he didn't see any bird. Instead, he saw colored laundry fluttering on bamboo poles stretched between the rails of balconies. Along the street, endless shop signs emblazoned with characters swayed like tattered banners. A uniformed Indian guard appeared, standing at the entrance to a grand stone building, his head turbaned and his beard trimmed. The air was musty and felt a little sticky. Summer can be insufferable here, Gary thought. Perhaps more such than Okinawa. A small boy in a patched gown accosted him, stretching out his carpet hand. But Gary recognized him. On his way to lunch, he'd given this same beggar 2 coins, so he shoot him away. An old woman was leaping over from the opposite direction, holding an oil paper umbrella under her arm. A rickshaw caught up with her to see if she needed a ride, but she waved it off. As Gary was nearing a street crossing, a midnight blue Rolls Royce with chrome lights and bumpers emerged, honking petulantly while the pedestrians jumped aside to make way. Still, the sedan spattered muddy water on some people and on the stands selling hot soy milk, magazines, flowers, fruits, deep-fried fish balls. A middle-aged woman in green slacks and rubber boots brandished her arms while yelling at the rear of the car, "Damn you, foreign devils!" Gary had only seen the Chinese chauffeur and another Asian face in the Rolls Royce, but he was sure it was a foreign car, as the UK flag on its fender showed. This reminded him that he'd been engaged in fighting imperialism. Yes, China had to drive all the colonial powers off its soil, and he'd better quit indulging in self-pity and fretting about his personal gain and loss. He ought to be more devoted to the cause of liberating the whole country. He stopped to pick up the South China Morning Post, which he'd found gave more coverage of international events than Chinese language newspapers.
Thank you. Well, here's a tip. If you want a real treat, you should go out and read the fiction and nonfiction of our next speaker, Sigrid Nunez. It's something that our students, and it's more than a treat. It's a deep pleasure and real enlightenment. And it's something that our students experience because we teach her book in our courses. Hajin teaches it every year. So Sigrid Nunez.
I'm reading a short story called Worried Sisters. Our sister has always caused us grief. A dyspeptic baby, a nervous, accident-prone little girl, abnormally, so we at least thought, even if the doctor poo-pooed this, sensitive to germs. Sneezing and hacking through every winter, and where we lived, winters were long. Everything went into her mouth. Take your eyes off her one instant, and she'd surely hang or choke or poison herself. Twice it ended in the emergency room. It was all we could do to pull her through childhood. Not a lovable child, but we loved her, of course. She was our sister. As she grew bigger, her problems grew too. She might have been a difficult, clumsy little girl, but at least she was happy. In her teens, she was never happy. The beauty of the family, to her own eyes, she was grotesque. She tortured her hair till it began to fall out, tortured her blemishes so that they left tiny scars. She ate too much and then too little, grew fat, grew thin, but of course, never thin enough. Once she punched a mirror into shards. Tears at the drop of a hat, rage at the merest suggestion of criticism, countless absences from school. Not normal. This time, the doctor agreed. Now there would always be doctors in her life and medications, new kinds of which kept coming on the market, but none of which seemed to help. She wanted to be an artist, but why put it that way? Were we out to destroy her? She didn't want to be an artist. She was an artist. And it was true that she won a full scholarship to art school, that soon after graduation she was awarded a prestigious Young Artist's Prize. But after this, encouraging signs were few. We could see for ourselves what a hard life it was, especially for one as sensitive to rejection and failure as she was. How would our baby ever survive? We tried to be supportive, turning the other cheek when she lashed out. We, with our ordinary lives and concerns, we who listened to the wrong bands and read the wrong books and made the mistake of calling paintings pictures, we could hardly be expected to understand her, nothing to do with blood. She often seemed just one long nose of disapproval. We confess that at times she scared us. In those days, she affected a drastic look, always in black, her dyed black hair stiffened into porcupine-like quills that said, "Back off or we'll shoot." She accused us of not caring whether she became a famous artist or not, and what could we say since it was true? Nobody was more selfish or narcissistic than the male artist, she always said, but that was the only kind of man she went for, and always so recklessly that when the relationship fell apart, she fell apart too. And then it was just as it had been when she was a child. She had to be watched every minute. When she turned 40, she kept a promise she had made to herself at 30. She gave up her studio and stopped making art. She took a job as a fundraiser for a small local museum. Though we would never have told her so, this change gave us hope. For the first time, she began dating someone who was not an egotistical young buck of an artist, but a soft-spoken man a few years older than she who worked for a company that sold office furniture. We could see how much our sister wanted things to work out. She tried not to compare her new boyfriend too much with the other, more exciting men she had been with, and to temper her disdain for his job. But the thought that she had settled for this man out of fear that she couldn't do better tormented her. He had no conversation, and certain personal habits that had always annoyed her turned out to be more than she could bear. One day she found a nail clipper and a pile of dirty toenails on the coffee table. Although she was sure she had made the right decision, the man was no sooner out of her life than she fell into her worst depression ever. Yet another new drug had recently become available, and her doctor urged her to try it. To everyone's surprise, it worked. Before our eyes, our sister passed from frantic despair to ordinary sadness. She got up every day and went to work. She ate, she slept, she went out with friends like any normal unhappy person. A year passed during which we caught up on our sleep and our reading, finished various projects, and played with our grandchildren. And then one day, our sister ran into her old ditched boyfriend on her way home from work. Now they are back together again. In fact, she says, they have never gotten along so well. The things that bothered her the first time around, those habits that took such a toll on her nerves, they now roll right off her back. He is no longer a man who never has anything to say, but the strong, silent type. We see. We knew that this was one of the effects of the miracle drug, a mellowing effect, enabling the depressive for the first time in her life to take daily annoyances and simple frustrations in stride. Not till now, however, did we understand that another effect of the drug was to protect the depressive from this very knowledge. Not being medicated ourselves, and knowing our sister as we do, we can see clearly that if she were not taking the drug, her feelings for this man would be the same as they were before. We know it's the pills talking when she tells us how much she wants to get married. We have discussed the matter between ourselves, but never with our sister. We don't want her to be alone, but we are troubled by the thought of her marrying someone that she would never agree to marry if she were not on the medication. We don't like to think what might happen if, for some reason, she were to stop taking it. We are relieved that at least she is past having children. No children will suffer, whatever happens. However, the man in question is a fine, decent human being whom we have always liked, and we are uncomfortable with the idea of his making such a life-changing decision when he is lacking all the information. Together, we compose a letter to the columnist who answers questions from readers in various moral quandaries for our local newspaper. We explain that the doctor has said there is no reason our sister shouldn't be able to stay on the medication for the rest of her life. But we have also heard of studies that say this might not be possible. The medication could lose its effect over time, or staying on it for too long might turn out to be in some way harmful. This now has become our new worry. We take our responsibilities seriously, but we don't know what is the right thing to do, whether to speak now or forever hold our peace. We do not sign our real names, of course, but rather her loving sisters. Thank you.
I see Robert is not wearing a skull cap tonight. I don't know why, but if he were, we could say that underneath that skull cap is the head that has conceived so many beautiful poems, has thought up so many ways to disseminate, improve, give poetry to the country and the wider world, who's done so much for our program. But the thing that I'd like to stress tonight is that although he's only 52 years old, he's just been presented with his seventh grandchild. Robert.
You'll be surprised to hear that the child is actually quite cute. The poem I'll read to you is called Poem with Refrains. The poem tells a kind of sad or miserable domestic personal story, and the refrains are there almost as a kind of, like in the pest house, it stinks and people took it. The meaning of the word nosegay, you take it and you smell through it, and the refrains are there just in a way to be beautiful and in contrast to the story. And the refrains are taken from the 16th century poetry that I love very much and that the present students in my seminar are reading as part of our writing workshop. So appropriately to the Jewish stuff and to the 16th century, I will read this poem called Poem with Refrains. The opening scene. The yellow, coal-fed fog uncurling over the tainted city river. A young girl rowing and her anxious father scavenging for corpses. Or funeral meats, or the clever abandoned orphan, or the great athletic killer sulking in his tent, as though all stories began with someone dying. When her mother died, my mother refused to attend the funeral. In fact, she sulked in her tent all through the year of the old lady's dying. I don't know why. She said because she loved her mother so much, she couldn't bear to see the way the doctors or her father or someone was letting her mother die. Follow your saint. Follow with accents sweet. Haste you, sad notes. Fall at her flying feet. She fogs things up. She scavenges the taint. Possibly that's the reason I write these poems. But they did speak on the phone, wept and argued so fiercely one or the other often cut off a sentence by hanging up in rage, like lovers. But all that year, she never saw her face. They lived on the same block, four doors apart. Absence my presence is, strangeness my grace, with them that walk against me is my son. Synagogue is a word I never heard. We called it shul, the Yiddish word for school. Elms, terracotta, the ocean a few blocks east. Lay institution. She taught me we didn't think God lived in it. The rabbi, just a teacher. But what about the hereditary priests, descendants of the Kohanim of the temple, like Walter Holtz? I called him Uncle Walter when I was small. A big man with a face just like a boxer dog or a cartoon sergeant. She told me whenever Walter helped a pretty woman try on a shoe in his store, he'd touch her calf and ask her, "How does that feel?" I was too little to get the point, but pretended to understand. Desire, be steady. Hope is your delight, an orb wherein no creature can be sorry. She didn't go to my bar mitzvah either. I can't say why. She was there, and then she wasn't. I looked around before I mounted the steps to chant that babble and the speech that the rabbi wrote, and there she wasn't. And there was Uncle Walter, the Kohen, frowning with his doggy face, quote, "She's missing her own son's musaf," end quote. Maybe she just doesn't like rituals. Afterwards, she had a reason I don't remember. I wasn't upset. The truth is, I had decided to be the clever orphan sometime before. By now, it's all a myth. What is a myth? But something that seems to happen always for the first time, over and over again. And 10 years later, she missed my brothers, too. I'm sorry. I think it was something about a hat. Hot sun, cool fire, tempered with sweet air, black shade, fair nurse, shadow my white hair. Shine, sun, burn fire, breathe air and ease me. She sees the minister of the Nation of Islam on television, though she's half blind in one eye. His bow tie is lime, his jacket crocodile green. Vigorously, he denounces the Jews who traded in slaves, the Jews who run the newspapers and the banks. "I see what this guy is mad about now," she says. "It must have been some Jew that sold him the soup." And the same wind sang and the same wave whitened, and or ever the garden's last petals were shed in the lips that had whispered, the eyes that had lightened. But when they unveiled her mother's memorial stone, gathered at the graveside 1 year after the death, according to custom, while we were standing around about to begin the prayers, her car appeared. It was a black car. The ground was deep in snow. My mother got out and walked toward us across the field of gravestones kept with snow, her coat black as the car, and they waited to start the prayers until she arrived. I think she enjoyed the drama. I can't remember if she prayed or not, but that may be the way I'll remember her best. Dark figure, awaited, attended, aware, apart. The present upon time passed striketh. With Phoebus's wandering course, the earth is graced. The air still moves, and by its moving cleareth. The fire up ascends, and planets feedeth. The water passeth on, and all lets weareth. The earth stands still, yet change of changes breedeth.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. We've just heard the annual faculty reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program. Our speakers were, in order of appearance, Dan Chasen, Creative Writing Program Director Leslie Epstein, who also moderated tonight's event, Ha Jin, Sigrid Nunez, and Robert Pinsky. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.